Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. He is a visiting scholar at Duke University, and his forthcoming memoir is on his 2 decades as an American reporter in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Savitt.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly there's a media blackout in China itself. It's now morning in China on the June 4th, they apparently have been pretty effective. There are more plainclothesmen on Tiananmen Square than there are tourists, they've obviously detained an awful lot of political activists, artists, lawyers, and other government critics before this 25th anniversary. And even a French film crew were nailed, had their film confiscated and had to actually appear on television in an apology. So the government is being pretty sensitive about this, but my understanding is that they basically eradicated most of the memories. So why are they so paranoid if we are to believe reports that in China most people have either forgotten it or too young to know about it?
Well, don't believe everything you hear about it being so effectively eradicated. Certainly, you know, it's 25 years, so there's a large portion of the population that wasn't born yet. But there's a piece on the front page of the New York Times today that points out how much dissent there was even in the military about that crackdown. And the thing about June 4th, 1989 is that it's still the one thing that could be used by a faction in the government. And if they could pin the blame for that on someone else, then that's just, it's remained a political hot potato. You might have the impression that, it's self-evident. If it didn't have weight, then why would it remain so sensitive 25 years later?
Well, the thing about the incident itself, which seems to be forgotten, is the politics of what was happening prior to it. My recall, and you were there, so just correct me if I get it wrong, but Hu Yaobang had died, and his funeral became a kind of magnet for the student movement because they admired him, and that the Chinese president at the time, Xia Jiang, was actually a liberal, quite a progressive guy. And he was reluctant to do anything about it and became under more and more pressure from the hardliners as this thing dragged on and as the students appeared on television haranguing their elders, etc. And eventually they got rid of, forced Xia Jiang out, and then the hardliners took over and made this decision, which, as you point out in the New York Times, some of the generals were unhappy about, particularly the major general in charge of the 38th Division. So just tell us about the politics. You were there before that, because what it leaves you the impression with, Scott, is the idea that China could have liberalized a lot earlier. You know, they could have had the Chinese Gorbachev back then, but for this incident and how the reactionaries took over.
Well, that is the revisionist history, and there are no do-overs in history. But everything that you just said is essentially accurate. But yeah, there were pre-existing circumstances. Well, the most important thing by far is 1989. The reforms had already been underway for close to a decade, and even though it wasn't the economy that it is today. I lived in China. I reported in China throughout the entire decade of the 1980s, and the transformation was tremendous already. And what they were trying to do was unravel the damage that Mao had done And one of the things they were trying to do, very controversial, was remove price controls on everything. I mean, there were, I myself used ration coupons throughout most of that decade, and they were doing away with it. And when you remove price controls, prices tend to rise. So there was pretty debilitating inflation. The thing they call corrupt officials, in the Chinese term for it is corrupt profiteering, and it's literally the verb that means to arbitrage. So if you're a Communist Party official, you can get the state price on, you know, any scarce resource and then turn around and sell it on the market for twice the price. And this is what Communist Party officials were doing, obscenely enriching themselves, and people were really angry about it. So when Hu Yaobang died on April 15th, 1989, the students saw it as an opportunity. And, you know, I lived right down the street from, our UPI office was right down the street from Tiananmen Square. So, you know, I remember when the people first came into the square and started putting up these white funerary wreaths. And if you know Chinese history, you know the last time that happened was after the popular premier Zhou Enlai died. And that was the original Tiananmen incident in 1976. And you know that it's extremely sensitive. And because there was a stalemate between the hardline faction and the moderate faction in the party, no one was willing to give the order to crack down. And the first day there were 100 people, and the next day there were 1 million people in Tiananmen Square. And that was it. Then you were going to have a real difficult time getting them out. And they continued to occupy that square for the next 7 weeks. There's still a dispute about what actually took place. But my conclusion is the hardliners actually used this as an opportunity to oust their liberal rival. And it was essentially a palace coup that didn't even accord with Communist Party constitutional principles. They actually, to oust the Communist Party General Secretary, they should have convened in a large meeting of the National People's Congress. So they didn't accord. And a lot of people think that, you know, they're the Communist Party, they can do anything they want. But actually, they always try to accord with their own internal procedures, if at all possible. So there were a lot of extraordinary things. And what this New York Times reporting, the significance of it is it reveals that there was a lot more dissent than people realized. And that I told somebody today, I said, this gives you a glimpse of when this stuff, and I believe it's when, not if, when it's reevaluated, this is the story that's going to be told. Because the People's Liberation Army, you know, they were humiliated by this. They got blood on their hands. And sooner or later, this is going to be pinned on somebody. Maybe after the principals are all dead, they're, you know, some of them are still alive. But, you know, if too much more time passes, then probably those guys will pass from the scene. But I do believe that this will go down in history as a tragic mistake, and still may be the nail in the coffin of the Communist Party of China.
Well, of course, it's a pretty hard to believe that the nail in the coffin wasn't hammered in decades ago because of the insanity of Mao Zedong. The Cultural Revolution was so unbelievably destructive, and then of course the modernization. Everybody had a kiln in their backyard making useless steel. And the country was starving. The insanity of what went on. I mean, I imagine after that was over, there was a huge sigh of relief. You just feel that country just has been tortured for so long, either by foreign occupiers and by mad emperors, and then this Mao and his crazy actress wife, etc. So is that, what's your sense of the of how much they've struggled.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's been a quite traumatic century. You know, here we are a little more than 100 years after the fall of the Qing Dynasty, and, you know, very, very tumultuous. Now, you know, the communists, the one thing that they... Mao was actually popular in the early years after the revolution because they were able to bring order to a country that had been riven by war and, you know, foreign invasion and civil war throughout the entire first half of the 20th century. So the communists come in and they're considered clean by previous standards, but of course they go back to the same old crazy ways. And as you pointed out, what Mao, you know, his economic policies were a disaster. So when he died and Deng Xiaoping took over in the late 1970s, really what China, a lot of people don't realize, they call it the economic miracle. There's no miracle whatsoever. You know, for the last 30 years, certainly impressive growth, but if you average it out over the 65 years that the communists have been in power, it's extremely average and actually what you would expect for a post-war reconstruction, which is what's taken place in the last 30 years, because there was no post-war, or 30, there was no post-war reconstruction under Mao. So, you know, they've crammed it all into three decades. You know, now they're recognizing that there have been huge environmental costs and social costs, and people are very, very dissatisfied. And that's how you understand this, why the party is so sensitive to anniversary. Essentially, I can tell you, you're going to wake up one day and there's going to be people back in the streets in China. And, you know, the question is, how would the government respond this time? You know, I have no doubt that they would give the order to fire again, but I do have doubt whether the military would carry it out. And that's what gives them sleepless nights.
And, of course, the irony was just in terms of the difference between what unraveled the Soviet Union and has, in effect, kept China together is that Gorbachev had glasnost, which was meant to stimulate perestroika, glasnost meaning what comes off the tip of your tongue, freeing people to talk about the system. The idea, of course, was to improve the system, but it effectively it suddenly exposed that the emperor had no clothes. And the Chinese have done the opposite. They've allowed perestroika, but not glasnost. But what I remember at the time of Tiananmen, guess who showed up? None other than Gorbachev, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it was the Sino-Soviet summit was the reason that the entire world press was there. Our bureau had, you know, bureau chiefs coming in from all over the place just to cover that event, because that was the first summit since Mao met Stalin. So that was, you know, significant in and of itself. And then you have the perfect storm of student protesters occupying the center of your capital.
And Gorbachev basically said, you know, they're out to lunch or something. I mean, he wasn't particularly helpful from my recollection.
Well, you know, you could tell. I covered his visit and, you know, spent time right around him, and you could tell that he was sympathetic to what the students were saying, because it was the same thing that he was saying in his system. And, you know, the attempt was, can you... There's an old Chinese saying, you know, it's ascribed to Deng Xiaoping, but it probably even dates back earlier. And they say, you know, if we don't address the rot in the system, then we're going to lose the party. But if we do address the rot in the system, then we're going to lose the country. So, or vice versa. I apologize. So, in other words, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And it's a very slippery slope. So even though China has loosened up the economic reins and not the political system, you know, sooner or later you hit a point where there's an emerging middle class in China, and you know, the general perception is people do not want things to continue. You know, a lot of times you'll hear it said that people are satisfied with the way things are. Do not believe that. It's simply not true. You know, people cite opinion polls. Chinese people don't tell what they really think to strangers taking surveys. So, you know, I stay in close contact with Chinese people all day, every day, and they are not happy with the way things are. And, you know, they finally do want that glasnost to go along with the perestroika, and are increasingly demanding it in all kinds of ways. You know, a lot of the successful protests are are environmental protests. So, you have a very effective NIMBY movement at present, and people realize, go out in numbers and get, you know, polluting industry moved, and that's that's the beginning of a of affected political activism.
Well, Scott Savitt, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, no problem, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. He's a visiting scholar at Duke University, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.